Hello, you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm your host this week, Ann Nicholson Weber, and I'm here today with Jimmy McDermott, who is artistic assistant at Writers Theater, and Michael Montenegro, who is a puppet maker and puppeteer, and Larry Newman Jr., who is the star of the current production at Writers Theater, which is the puppet master of Lotz, I'll say, which I think is not correct, but we'll do for now. So welcome to you three, and thank you for coming.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I think it would make sense to start, maybe, Jimmy, if you could just summarize the premise of the play so that we can talk about it in a way that isn't confusing.
Surely. It takes place in an attic in Berlin in 1950, and this attic has become the home of Samuel Finkelbaum, who is a puppet master. He's our title character. He's been displaced from the city of Lodz, as he would say in Yiddish, or what's modernly pronounced in Poland as Łódź, L-O-D-Z, spelled just like it sounds. And he is presumably or allegedly an escapee from Auschwitz, Birkenau to be specific. And he's holed himself up in an attic in Berlin now for 5 years and has refused to believe that the war is over, you know, which it has been almost soon after he arrived there. Despite his landlady's daily attempts to lure him out, he has built a really Byzantine sort of belief system as to why the war is still going on. And during the course of the day that we meet this character, a series of mysterious visitors come to lure him out all the while. Between those visits, he is attempting to rehearse a puppet show, which is the story of his life. And there's a bit of a mystery as to Finkelbaum's ultimate identity, but what we do know and what he does prove to us throughout the play is that his identity before the war was a puppet master. And so most of his interaction takes place with puppets that he's created and cobbled out of his immediate environment. Mm-hmm. And that is the premise.
Well, one of the most interesting to me aspects of this play and perhaps most unique things about it is the importance of the puppets. Some of them are characters, key characters in the play, and his role, his identity as puppet master is obviously very central to the themes of the play and the story, which is why Michael Montenegro is here, who created these puppets and, as I understand it, helped Larry to learn how to manipulate them. And I guess my first question is for Larry. It strikes me that this is a little bit as if someone said to you, okay, we have a role for you as a juggler, and you need to learn to juggle in the next 3 weeks. Is that an apt comparison?
That's pretty apt, but you have to say it's a juggling with an axe and maybe an egg. But it's been one of the most challenging roles and one of the most rewarding productions I've ever done. Mm-hmm. We have talkbacks occasionally after the performance, and it just fills me with so much pride when the people who've seen the performance will say, "She was alive," you know. And I credit Jimmy and Michael for that. We started workshops before the actual rehearsals. And one of the key things that Michael said was, if you believe she's alive, then the audience will believe she's alive. And so taking that premise and working through the rehearsal process and, you know, just trying to keep that thought alive, at times it was very frenetic and very schizophrenic. And, you know, it's like, I can't do this. You know, I can't do this. But, you know, with persevation or whatever, it kept going. And I think people have a wonderful experience with the work that we've done up there.
Yeah, that's clearly true. Well, Michael, can you talk about how you go about teaching someone how to be a puppeteer in 2 weeks or whatever it was you had before rehearsals began?
Well, it helps to be working with people who are very talented to begin with, and of course, Larry, being an actor, he's no stranger to the use of your body and voice and all the things that you need to work a puppet. I think when I work with somebody in the beginning, I try to focus on breathing, the puppet's breathing and connecting that puppet breathing to the actor's breathing, and somehow that works very on a visceral level to make the connection. I've found through trial and error that seems to be the best method.
What does that mean in really concrete terms if we're talking now about the puppet in the play who is Finkelbaum's wife? I don't remember her being a puppet who could breathe in any obvious way. So what would that mean in the rehearsal moment? What are you doing?
Can I throw that question to Larry? Because I'd be curious to know what your experience was with that concept, you know.
One of the things, and I don't think I'm revealing too much, when the audience comes in, they're presented with the attic where they live, and there's two people lying in that bed. And for 20 minutes, as they're coming in, the two of us are in the bed, and so there's that time for myself and her to become sort of in tune and in sync at the very beginning of the play, and then we proceed from there. At one point, we thought it might be distracting to have the two of us in the bed as the audience is coming in, I think, and we thought, well, let's try and get us in there in the blackout. But it was like it drove me nuts because I needed that time with her, you know, before the actual play begins. And I think that's what that 20 minutes while the audience is coming in, what that does for me is.
Well, did you use that idea of the breath when you were?
Oh, sure.
And what were you doing?
Just the two of us just breathing.
So you were imagining her breathing?
Sure.
I mean, this brings up such an interesting, to me, idea of the technique of operating a puppet is very objective. You have to think, okay, what does someone look like when they are some emotion? You know, they're angry. And then how can I make this object look like that? As an actor, I guess it can be done many different ways, but many actors don't think from the outside, how do I look? You just imagine yourself angry and your body responds. So what happens to you as an actor when you're trying to do both at once?
A lot of it is kind of splitting the focus of keeping the physical world and knowing what has to be done in order to convey to the audience what she's experiencing or what I'm experiencing. And if those two things are in conflict, that's where the schizophrenia comes in, because you have to keep both of those alive and, you know, immediate. And so that's, it becomes, it's a skill, it's a technique that you have to work on, and hopefully, you know, you'll get it.
Was it hard? I mean, you're a very experienced actor by now, and now you're doing something that you're really a novice at. Mm-hmm. How did that feel?
It was very, what's the word I want? It was a question of going back down to the, I have no experience at this, like you said, and feeling like this is beyond me. I don't know what I'm doing. No one is going to believe this. It's just, it's awful. So it's a lot of self-worth.
A lot of torment.
Questions, yeah. And it's funny because the play deals so much with being a puppet master, of comparing that to being a god. In other words, you have the ability to give life or take away life. And as the puppet master in the play, that's a theme and an issue that's brought up constantly throughout the performance. And by being a novice at this, it really made me hone in on that, you know, what that whole issue is. Mm-hmm. As far as what is control, do we have control? Is it some other fate or whatever? So it was, you know, in hindsight, it was a good thing.
Well, for Michael, for you too, there was something I would think very challenging about your role in this production, which is that you weren't just designing puppets, but I imagine you were essentially designing puppets in character. That is, you were designing the puppets that this character would have made. Did that enter into what you did or not?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I struggled with that a little bit at different times, partly because there's a little bit of a conflict, artistic conflict, in that I wanted the puppets to look really rough as if they were tagged together by odd things that might be found in an attic. But my ego also would step in and say, you know, you want to do something that you're really proud of aesthetically. So there's a bit of a struggle there, if I'm making myself clear.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You didn't want to be as limited as you would have been if you had completely stuck to that premise that you could only have what he might have had.
Yeah, I think specifically the little puppet, Finkelbaum puppet itself, I felt compelled to craft it in a way that it would be very compelling as a little figure because of its role. Mm-hmm. And so I felt the conflict there. You know, should he be made out of junk or with a doorknob head or and then I think, Jimmy, I toyed with that little mask and you said, yeah, let's use that face. I don't know. We struggled with those kinds of things. Very interesting process.
Well, there are kind of three Finkelbaums involved in this, because there's the puppet of Finkelbaum and there's the character Finkelbaum, and then there's a real puppet master in the mix, you making puppets. And I could imagine that Larry might have thought a lot about who you are and thinking about what kind of person makes puppets. I don't know. I mean, did you think about that?
I observed.
Uh-huh. I could imagine.
He looked at me through a big magnifying glass.
I mean, did you learn something about the character as you started to work with puppets and started to work with Michael?
Yes. Yeah. I think that was the key about the three of us being in that workshop environment in Michael's studio, was creating and getting to know one another and getting to know how to, what kind of vocabulary, if that's a strange word to use for puppetry, but the vocabulary of the puppets and how one interacts with them. Mm-hmm. It's slightly different than, you know, you and I talking, because we have to convey that without a thought, quote unquote, coming from the other person.
Right, right.
But there is thought there, especially the way this is created.
That was something I thought about, that you have a lot of scenes that are with another character, except there's no other actor there, which would be one way you can get energy for doing a scene. So you're essentially creating the energy for two characters.
Yeah.
It sounds very exhausting.
it can be. I think by the end of the week, I'm a little spent. Uh-huh. But the other thing is that there's the audience, and there's the energy I get from them. Mm-hmm. Any actor will tell you, you know, that the energy. I mean, that's why it's so lovely to do live theater, is because the energy that you feel coming from the audience, either through response or just they're listening, and you can tell, you know, and by having that to ride on, then it can carry you through.
Yeah. I mean, you've done one-man shows, so I guess...
Yes, I have. Yeah.
You know you can do that. Well, Jimmy, what was your role during those 2 weeks of... Was it 2 weeks? I kind of made that up.
Actually, we did during the workshop period.
Yeah.
We did it over the course of a month. I think we did once a week
longer,
for several hours.
Mm-hmm.
My role was to... was to take it in and I think towards the end of it, we started dealing with a little more practical behaviors as it was in terms of the play, in terms of, there's a breakfast scene that is sort of complicated where Finkelbaum and his wife eat breakfast together. Mm-hmm. And we began to work on things like that. And the concentration camp sequence had to be sort of designed a little bit more in advance. We used the time to... have some preliminary designs, work with those preliminary designs, toss a good deal of them out, and retrofit them for what the needs of the piece were going to be. Mm-hmm. There's a scene as written, which is the concentration camp sequence that I'm referring to, where Finkelbaum relives a moment in the concentration camp through his puppets, and it's written to be all done with marionettes. And in part of this, Finkelbaum reveals himself to be a member of the Sonderkommando, where he would burn the bodies of fellow inmates. And as written, it states that a marionette takes up these other marionettes, these sort of fallen marionettes, and creates a pile of them. And we realized pretty quickly that the marionette we had designed to do that wasn't necessarily capable of getting that sort of purchase on these other bodies and taking them away. And luckily, Michael and I wound up at this at a puppetry festival, and there was a little puppet in that. It was sort of this modified one-man Bunraku puppet, which is a rod puppet, and that in that sequence, what the man was doing was sort of inexplicable. I couldn't tell you what it was, but the puppet did have to grab things and articulate movement with it, and succeed in placing them places. So, luckily, we both had that as sort of a reference point, and I asked Michael, well, could we modify this marionette to behave like that? And it seemed to be actually a rather easy fix, and. Mm-hmm. It was a hell of a lot more eloquent than something on strings attempting to mm-hmm. lift something and then having a 10% chance of that ever working right. at any given run. And we right. have 5 months of shows to do here.
Right. So. Batting 100. uh-huh. One of the very interesting things to me about the premise of the play and its effect on the audience is this, that when you see puppets, part of the pleasure of it is if you can actually see them as animated, if you, you know, experience them as alive in front of you. But in this play, it's also very important that at the same time, you know they're not. It's essential. I mean, the irony of it is that Finkelbaum is believing or trying to believe that they're real, and we're watching that and feeling terrible mm-hmm. because of that. So it's to me, it plays with the audience's suspension of disbelief in a very interesting way, and the playwright does that again with these secondary characters that come in, they're played by the same actor. And the second time he comes back, you say, "Oh, they double cast it." Mm-hmm. You know, they just wanted to use one actor. I know that's a different character, but I'm going to play along that it's a different person. I know it's the same actor. I'm going to pretend it's a different person. And then the third time it happens, something happens in the production that's meant to reveal to you that in fact it is one character. It's not one actor playing two characters. Mm-hmm. So again, it's almost like we've been tricked because we said, okay, I'll go along with this. Yes. I'll suspend my disbelief. I'll believe that that's a different person. And then we're told, oh, no, it's actually the same person. What did you as a director mean to happen to us? Is the play about that?
I think it's the playwright playing with your preconception of what theater conventions are mm-hmm. is that often you see a character that's double cast and you're like, oh, that's the same guy just in a mustache. But
right.
but of course, you know, he's in a mustache. He's someone
but
different.
I'll play along. I'll believe.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then I think he plays directly into that, and that these two characters we see in the first time are pretty specifically drawn in a way where you say, okay, well then yes, it's not some guy trying to play a trick. And then when he tells you that it is trying to play a trick, it cracks the play open in a different mm-hmm, way.
Yes.
The play begins almost as this sort of dark-hued vaudeville in a way, mm-hmm. I think. And then it takes a bit of a Twilight Zone turn for a moment. Like, is the 1950 right. that we know to have happened truly the 1950 that we're witnessing in this play?
Right.
Is Finkelbaum? It is suddenly in the, there's a moment in that play where Finkelbaum's delusion is lent a great deal of credibility,
right?
And that suddenly made the play suspenseful. When I was reading the play, I would say that was the very moment that won me to it. How long can this premise keep up? Mm-hmm. This guy who can't believe the war is over. I have 60 more pages to read here,
right.
And is it all going to be this? And then I was given that moment and said, this is terrific.
Suddenly it has a Pinter feeling or something.
Yeah,
there's this menace that we don't know whether to believe
yes,
in or not.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
It was just, for me, it wasn't really so much interpretive. It was just a matter of serving that,
mm-hmm.
that sense of, how do I create for an audience the sense that I had when I read this, and which is, suddenly the whole style of the play has changed.
Right.
And that's really terrific. I really love pieces that where like the true genre benders that shift either with an event like that, but almost in a way imperceptibly, where the style doesn't totally shift. You have to plant the seeds for something like this to credibly occur mm-hmm. after at a moment like that. So that was the challenge too. Is it's like, you know, how do you create a tone where that shift could happen and that it's jarring enough, but at the same time not.
Like, oh, let's start another play.
Exactly.
We're in a different play all of a sudden. There was something else to me that was very moving, and I don't know if this is just one of those things that happens because of strengths of the text and maybe just luck. I don't know. But I had a moment when Finkelbaum and Rukula, his wife, the puppet, are together, and he's wearing a kind of long johns, and it's open at the chest. So I'm suddenly seeing Larry, the actor's body, very conscious of this real flesh and blood person next to the puppet. And the puppet is designed in a way, well, maybe you could talk about that, Michael, that she's kind of incomplete. I don't know if that's the word you would want to use, but can you explain, which to me created a contrast to this real person. I mean, you're very aware of her being made of wire. Was that something you did on purpose, and what was in your mind as you did it?
Very much so. This is an interesting thing to me was that I kind of theorized, I guess, in my mind that the less real Rukula became, the more interesting Finkelbaum was, because he was placing so much believability upon this less than real puppet figure. So if you made her super real, then the mystery of it would be less. And I really worked with Jimmy on where that line should be, because at early on we had a puppet that was really abstracted, really no hands, no feet, which was very haunting in a different way. And for Finkelbaum to believe in this thing mm-hmm. that was very much not a human being could have been very powerful too in a different way. So we toyed with where to stop with. In fact, we had a face for a while, and Jimmy was very insistent that the face not be there, that it be a suggestive face, and I think he's very right there. So mm-hmm. those little decisions were intriguing.
Yeah.
Is that kind of answering?
No, it does, saying? Absolutely. I mean, I think that you're right. The incompleteness means that it maybe goes back to what I was talking about before, which is we're watching him believe in something that we're not completely drawn into the way we might be with a more complete
Might
puppet.
Be. That's the intriguing
Maybe
thing
not,
about puppets.
Maybe not, you're saying, because you can project onto
project.
A blank screen more.
Exactly. I mm-hmm. think that's exactly right. And the more, I think maybe, Jimmy would have to talk about this maybe, but I think the face that I put on there was too specific. Although I was sort of in love with the face as a face, mm-hmm. I think for Jimmy it was too specific, and consequently the audience couldn't project. And maybe Larry, too, would have a harder time projecting onto a real face mm-hmm. and had an easier time, maybe.
I'm certainly glad you started with the face, because it gave us somewhere to go, and there is a sense of a face in the play, in the puppet as it is. I mean, we have this sort of gauzy bandage over the existing face, and we do get to see features in a sort of low relief, and I like it. Much of the way the face that we added to the little Finkelbaum puppet, in a way, it in order to give, it gives an audience a sense of direction and perspective as to what this thing is viewing. And one of the important little exercises that Michael was taking Larry through in the workshop period was a look touch situation, where you take a puppet and the puppet sees this thing in front of them, spots it, and then reaches for it and to make contact with it. And it just speaks volumes. I mean, I think it's the principle of any puppetry that you can do, is that this thing, and it's inherently dramatic. It's there's this thing. I want this thing. I'm going for this thing. And it's really important. And it helped actually to have these slight suggestions of features on both of those puppets, that they're able to lock onto something, and we recognize that. The puppet as written is was written to be a featureless puppet, and Michael sort of began creating it in an organic way, and it was really great. I think we wound up with the best of both worlds in mm-hmm. that we have these features. They're slightly obscured, and I'm really glad that you said that she feels like this incomplete creature, like she's still in progress. There's sort of this Bride of Frankenstein idea that something's under the bandages and it will eventually realize itself as something. But at the same time, is this well-worn and tattered thing that he uses, that he behaves with every day.
Yeah, yeah. I seem to remember her hands being sort of dirty looking, just because you feel that he's been mm-hmm. touching her for all these years.
Yeah. Well, a couple of her fingers have broken off in the course of rehearsal.
She really is getting worn.
So we do patch her up.
Right.
And luckily, the aesthetic of the play lends itself to that. I mean, there's going to be a lot of wear and tear on the materials in this play, and these quick patch jobs, I mean, they lend themselves to the logic.
Yeah.
Luckily.
Right.
Lucky for us.
Well, Larry, what I imagine with any role, it's true that there must be some scene or some moment that you think, I am never going to figure out how to do this. I am never going to be able to do this. What was one of those in this show?
I would have to say, I guess, one of the most challenging sequences is the doctor sequence.
Yes.
Why don't you explain just a little bit what that is?
Finkelbaum decides that Rukla is very close to giving birth, and so he needs to have a doctor there. So he creates, he has a doctor puppet also come, and they're going through an examination of Rukla. So there's the doctor, there's me, there's Rukla, and there's also his father. It's labor pains. So there's that whole frenetic energy of a birth, of a labor, and also the demands of the script as far as how much of this can he sustain,
mm-hmm.
and where does this whole sequence lead him? And even to this day, it's still, when I get to that sequence, it's like, here we go.
Take a deep
and we'll see
breath.
What happens
right.
when we get to the end of it.
Does it end up coming out different ways, different nights?
Oh, sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What's the range of tone that it takes? It has almost a Monty Python quality to it, doesn't
there's that
it?
To I mean, it. It's there's absurdist humor as far as, you know, the whole vaudeville of, you know, oh, the husband's going to help with the birth, and that, you know, all the comedy that's involved in there. But there's also the franticness and the desperation of wanting to have this child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's ultimately revealed at the end of that scene is that she's not due to bring this person. And there's this sort of frantic vaudeville that's shut down by this news that she's not ready yet ready to deliver, which is this sense that this experience has been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that, and it comes at a point in the play where Finkelbaum needs to bring the play into some sort of absurd sequel in a way. It's like, let's add a new life to this. Let's bring another character into this. And maybe I can just simply desperately will it into being. And he fails.
You can't.
Yes.
Yeah. It's very sad and very funny, obviously, for us.
That's the hope.
Yeah. Well, the puppeteer as God is, and is there a God, is very important, certainly comes back and back in the text. And I just couldn't resist asking you, Michael, is that real as a puppeteer? Do you feel godlike?
Absolutely not.
Say more.
Strange question. Yeah, no, I people have asked me strange things about puppets. Often do you talk to them and this kind of thing, but nobody's ever asked me that before. But no, it's never occurred to me.
I mean, the playwright seems to think, and Finkelbaum, the character, feels that there's something about manipulating puppets that feels godlike. And
I think my experience is more of being in awe at the strangeness of this art form and activity. I always feel like I'm dabbling in something that's somewhat mysterious, and I think all artists feel that way to a certain degree. You know, it's art has a certain side to it that's borders on the mysterious, and I think that's what attracts us to it. You know, puppets included.
It's a very ambitious play in that way. I mean, he's digging into very deep, big things, and a very ambitious production of it, and very successful, obviously, from the audience's reactions and critical responses. I think you said you felt that from the audience at the talkback the other night, just how keenly people are listening and being moved. Well, thank you guys so much for talking about this. I appreciate your time.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.